As a major research institution, Arizona State University offers the most online bachelor's degree programs, along with world-class faculty and dedicated support. Discover why ASU is ranked number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years. Tap to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Dan Nguyen, AKA Demon Slayer. I'm a Vietnamese American born in Southern California and spending my time between Vietnam and the US. I'm a visual artist, a creative director, and also a music producer and DJ. And overall, in the creative realm and space, mentally and physically. No, wait, that part is stupid.
That was perfect. I love it. That was perfect. Dope.
Oh my God.
Do you mind if I keep that? That was perfect. Yeah. I like the outburst at the end. That was fun.
Okay, good. Yeah, good.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
To be Vietnamese, it's a really deep question, but I think the short answer I would say is to be present here now, wherever we are in the world, but at the same time to honor our DNA, our lineage, it doesn't have to be like, we don't have to speak Vietnamese to be Vietnamese, because the ancestry is there, the spirit is there. And I feel like we're all connected through that.
Yeah, I agree. I got called out recently about this question. What does it mean to be Vietnamese? Not called out in a challenging way, but it's more like, is the question limiting? Because we could be anything. We're fluid. We're human beings, and we can basically, we can be whatever the hell we want. What does it mean to be Vietnamese? Mm-hmm. And my reply is, I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question. I really don't know. This is exactly why I'm here, is to hear what other people are feeling or what they're thinking about who they are, if they're called Vietnamese. I just want to know what the guests think. It's nothing more, other than that. It's nothing more than that. It's just, I want to hear what your version of being yourself, being called Vietnamese, is. That's it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great question, actually, because when you ask a broad question like that, the guest can answer it anyway. And I think that tells a lot about, both of us, the guest and you, the host, and also about, because I think we're collectively finding out what that is.
Yeah.
The definition is continually getting redefined, Like, if you ask me on a different day, it'll probably be a different answer.
I agree with that. It's changing all the time. So right now, today, what does that mean? But a year from now, you and I could both be sitting down and, it definitely could change. It should change, totally. Right?
I think so, yeah. Because like you say, humans, we're fluid, We're not, if we choose not to be, we don't have to be defined by any label or category, So I think it changes all the time.
And the fact that you have spent so much time in Vietnam and you're born here, right?
Yeah.
So all of those things going, and then I think spending some years here back and then going back to Vietnam, back and forth, every time that happens, that changes as well, right?
Yes, bro. Yeah, totally, dude. Like, I didn't like when I first moved. I've been going to Vietnam, you know, once every couple years, like as a kid with my parents and stuff. But when I finally moved back there and lived there, you know, last 12 years, like my definition of what is Vietnamese changes constantly. Like, it, you know, if I come back to the States for a month, it's different. If I go out to the States for 3 months, it's different. It's constantly changing. But what is consistent is that I feel Vietnamese as hell. Like even after, you know, being in the States or being born here, like it feels like home, you know, like not Vietnam, but being Vietnamese. And before I didn't understand that. Before I realized I was really American, you know, if that makes sense. Like totally American dude. But then like afterwards, spending time in Vietnam, I realized like, you know, we can have two homes instead of just one home. So
yeah. Now, when you first started going back to Vietnam as a kid, what were your thoughts then?
Well, when I first came back to Vietnam, I was, I think, 9, and that was my first trip out of the U.S. And we went to, because my dad's side is from Rat Ya, which is like 8 hours south of Saigon, so it's a smaller city, and it's, at that time, it was a little bit more, you know, like not westernized. So when I got there, I was like, yo, it's hot as hell. Where are the X-Men? Why are mosquitoes chewing up my legs? Like, me and my younger brother were so annoyed, dude, because, you know, we're little American kids. We're used to, you know, toilet seats. We're used to, you know, AC and, like, you know, Cheetos, you know, but we go there and it's just total opposite of what we're used to. We were not prepared. So our first trip, my brother and I were like, yo, this place sucks. Like, but the food was really good, but this place sucks. And it's nice to see family, and then, you know, we were there for 3 months. So towards the end of the month, the third month, like we were part of the neighborhood. We were like playing with all the local kids and, you know, shooting marbles and like, and like there was a game where, so someone in the neighborhood had a giant anaconda in a cage. So we would go rat hunting to go feed the anaconda.
Damn.
And that was awesome for a kid because we had slingshots and we were shooting rocks at rats with like 5 other kids our age. So we'd run around the neighborhood and be like, oh crap. And then like, you know, I don't remember if it was my brother or one of the kids, but one of them killed a rat and it was huge. And then so the third kid came and like didn't even put a glove on or anything, just grabbed it by the tail. And then like we went into the man's pad and I was like, yo, this place it looked wild. And then, you know, going through like bees, it looked like Indiana Jones. And then we go into his room and there's a giant cage, like a queen size bed. And then he pulls the fabric, the cloth out, and it's a giant anaconda, dude. I was like,
in a cage?
In a cage, yeah. And the cage was as big as the bed. I felt sorry for bro, because like he was just wrapped around, you know? And then, so the man opened the top of the cage and dangled the rat, and the anaconda was really slow. Like he just lifted his head, and then in a blink of an eye, and then like, the rat was in its mouth. I was like, damn, this fool has, I was like, I didn't know they could move that fast, you know, but they could, because they're just all muscle. So then after that, we're like, yo, Vietnam's pretty crazy. It like totally unlocked our mischievous side. And it's wild when you ask, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? Because now when I think about it, while we were running around, you know, shooting rats, like jumping into the river, like riding bikes, I felt Vietnamese, like super Vietnamese. And this is like, you know, that's what I meant about activating that DNA. Cause you know, before that I didn't know what Vietnamese was. I was like a 9-year-old American boy, you know, but as I was there playing with everyone else, like, you know, looking around in the neighborhood and stuff. I, like, we didn't feel different in those moments, you know, because, you know, at that time, Viet Q coming back to Vietnam, it was like a big deal, especially in a smaller town, you know, like everyone knows each other. Everyone knows everything that's happening, all the gossip, all the news. So here comes American family coming back after years, you know? So the whole neighborhood is like, you know, focused on us. And it was really awkward, but towards the end of the 3 months, I, you know, we felt like home. And yeah, then I think that's when I realized, like, yeah, we are truly Vietnamese, you know?
What a cool story. You know, I just recently, God, I've known of this book for a long time, but it's called Howard Zinn's The People's History of the U.S. Have you ever heard of
yes,
it?
Yes, I know that book. That's a great book. Yes.
Fuck. I've heard of it for a long time.
And changed my life in high school.
I really do wish that I would have read that book a lot sooner. I've just started in the first two chapters, but it reminds me, when you tell me of that story of playing in the neighborhood and how connected you got as a result of, you know, just being in that scenario. And then you read about the way Christopher Columbus arrived on the shores in the opening chapter and how their whole army just annihilated these tribes of Indians on the coast. And you realize how disconnected we are as a people, and you start to go backwards and think about, like, the Vietnam War, and, you know, all the way back to 1530 and 1492, and you just go back into all these years, and you're like, human beings have really done a number on each other and really dislocated people's sort of natural. Because when I hear this anaconda story, right, I'm like thinking, when you grew up in Riverside or the U.S. somewhere in the city or even in the suburbs, you don't get a chance to experience any of that kind of shit. You don't get to experience that. Or, you know, they call it tam mưa, which is you're out in the street in Vietnam and you're playing with all the kids when it's raining.
Yeah, dancing in the rain.
Dancing in the rain. All of these things are we're deprived of. And, you know, but that's just being human and being able to return to that. And that's just one slither, no pun intended, of your life in Vietnam growing up. And now it makes me curious to ask you, you know, what were those ensuing years like, you know, as you were growing up? And, you know, you probably didn't think of your art or becoming an artist at that time, or did you?
I was always drawing since I was a kid, but at that time my parents were like, so we're excited you're going to be a lawyer, or like, we're really looking forward to your physician job. There was no art or music allowed. They're like, you want to draw when you grow up? You want to sit on the beach and draw portraits and caricatures of people walking by for $5?
They literally said this?
Yeah, they literally said this.
Well, what did they do?
Well, they came over here to the States when my mom was 18 and my dad was 22.
Oh, shit. They were young.
They were super young. And they worked a bunch of different jobs. And then we got a little bit stable when our family was opening, or we opened some furniture stores, like high-end furniture stores. And then our whole family did really well. And then when the recession happened, then like it all not crumbled, but downsized, you know? And then they continued in that for a while. And then now they're just retired and chilling. Like, we have a little farm that they work on. So they came from Vietnam, from, you know, education and, you know, super working class, you know? So they just expected me to do the same, because at that time, art in Vietnam was very niche, you know? It wasn't a career move. Like, it was non-existent. Like, in Vietnam, you could be a painter and have exhibitions, but painting fell under academia. So it wasn't like, hey, I'm going to express myself. Hey, I'm going to, you know, like embody my spiritual journey through visual arts. It wasn't anything like that. Like painting back then was like, hey, I'm going to have some exhibitions. Here's a painting of, you know, a girl in an aoyai, like with like a conical hat, using traditional Vietnamese methods. That's all it was, you know? So when they came here to the States, that was their impression of art. And they're like, why would you go to America and just paint, you know? Like, this is the land of opportunity, you know? Like, why don't you be a lawyer or a doctor, like all the other Vietnamese kids were doing, you know? So yeah, they weren't supportive. And there was times later in my teenage life where my dad was really against my work and would like, you know, be like, he was like, what are you doing? Why are you doing art? Like, come on, you gotta, you know, do this and that. And, you know, and that was like a huge struggle because, I got really like confused and angry, you know, I'm like, bro, why don't you just let me do what I want to do and support me, you know, like not even support me financially, but just be like, go for it.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a problem that a lot of Vietnamese and Vietnamese Americans face, you know. But I kept going, and you know, I think that's probably that friction is probably what drove me to where I am now. So essentially I'm successful now because they you know, were so against it, you know. Now they're not so much against it. They've seen my journey and they're like, "Okay, cool." But, you know, for me, my parents, they're not very expressive. So they're not like, yo, bro, you're killing it. They're just like,
you know, we need that. We need that. When I think about it now, I'm happy that our community has this problem, quote unquote problem about,
yeah,
you know, not supporting the artists and not, and, you know, and kind of giving it a weird different pressure, like going to be a doctor or whatever. Because what I'm starting to see a little bit is guys like you, where you're expected to do something or they're just kind of quiet and not supportive. You end up having this sort of what you said as friction. And that friction creates people like Viet Thanh Nguyen, and it creates people like Chi Quy Mai, you know, these writers, these artists that have something that's like an itch inside, and it just kind of festers, and that festering creates this expression. And the more we get of that, too bad it's just like plain, you know, like pressure becoming a doctor, a lawyer, or whatever. But, you know, the stranger the pressure, the more, you know, the more output or the more diverse the output of the art possibly.
Yeah, I agree 100%, dude. Like, I used to be really frustrated about that, you know, like I would see other Vietnamese kids or just other kids in general, like not even Vietnamese, their parents are like, you know, very supportive, like vocally, you know, mentally, financially. And I used to be like, why not me? Why? But you know, now I look back, I'm like, wow, I recognize this drive inside of me.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it comes from. It's not, I'm not trying to be famous or successful or something. I just have this thing inside me every day where I'm like, okay, I have to do this thing. I still don't understand what it is, you know, but yeah, that struggle really pushed me. And you know, when I went back to Vietnam and lived there and got to know the mentality, the tradition and the heritage and process all of the cultural differences is when I realized that my parents actually weren't mean. They're just Vietnamese. You know, they weren't trying to hold me back on purpose. They weren't trying to dissuade me. They were just doing what they knew. They were just being traditional Vietnamese, like, hey, son, grow up and have a good career and have a family, which generally is, I think, what a lot of people from that generation was pushing, you know, even in the States, you know, it's like, get a house, two cars, some kids, you're good, you know. So I was fighting against that. And also, you know, all like the wild racism. And I used to fight a lot, like physically. Like,
really?
Yeah, like I grew up, you know, there was a huge part of my life that was around Asian gangsters, And, you know, we would do, you know, ratchet, mischievous things, you know.
Wait, so, I can't let you go without, like, talking about that. Okay, so wait. What do you mean by that? Like, you were in a gang?
Yes. I was in a gang, a really big Vietnamese gang.
Can you tell me what gang?
No. Because it's, I don't want to implicate anything. But I wasn't, like, a super bad kid. My cousin, second cousin, was heavy into that. And by proximity, I was too. But during the 90s, like late 90s, early 2000s, if you're Asian American and in SoCal, you were either a gangster or like gangster related, or you were kind of like quiet.
You were in school. Yeah, exactly. You were in school. You were either a gangster, you were hanging out with the gangs, or you were in school. There was no kind of in between. You couldn't just exist in the 90s. Yeah.
You couldn't just exist. And, you know, like I was a nerd. I mean, I'm still a nerd. Like at that time I loved comics. I still love comics. Like I loved all the nerdy stuff and music and art. And then I was in the gang. So it was a weird
intersection
time for me as well, because at school I would hang out with like the nerdy kids and like, you know, the white kids into punk music, the different scenes, like all, I was very like everyone, you know? And then my Asian gangster homies were just with other Asians and other gangsters. And they were always confused, like, yo, bro, why you hang out with those dorks, man? And then my nerdy friends are like, those guys are scary. Like, you're gonna ditch school again? You know, like, I'm like, yeah, sorry, Tommy. You know, and it was really weird. It was really weird. But, you know, looking back, like, at that time, I thought I was just hanging out. I was like, I'm just hanging out, just having a great time. And my friends, you know, just so happened to be gangsters and like, you know, steal cars and go on road trips and stuff, you know? And at the time it was so normal to me, but looking back now, I'm like, what the hell was I doing? Like, why didn't I listen to my parents?
You know? But what motivated so many kids at that time to join these gangs? I mean, you had both parents that were, sounds like they were decent people and happily married. Why would that create some sort of turmoil for you to join some crazy shit like that?
It was society, because a lot of the kids had came from, you know, great homes and were actually nice people. But the way society was at that time, it was wild, dude. It was still very racist. I mean, it is now, but back then it was like super racist. You know, even though I grew up in Riverside, there's Asians everywhere. There's Mexicans everywhere. There's Black people everywhere. Still very racist against Asians. Like Asians didn't have our own community. We didn't have like an identity. We didn't have like the young kids. Like, you know, there was basically our parents who were like refugees, our fobs, and then us. Like, where do we fit in? We're first generation. We're born here. There's no one before us. Like, we're creating our future. Like, we didn't have, there wasn't, you know, Asian book club, or there wasn't like, there weren't things to belong to. There was the gangster scene. There was the racer scene, like, you know, modified Hondas, tuners, imports. And that was tied in with the Asian scene. Like most of the car nerds were gangsters. And then outside of that, there was like a really small music scene, a couple of Asians doing stuff. But I feel like it was because of society, you know, and, you know, everyone else banded together. Like all the Mexicans hung out together, all the Black kids hung out together, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't diverse like it is now.
Yeah.
You know, so that caused us to band together and have pride in being Vietnamese, being Asian American. But at the same time, it also caused friction within the Asian group. So a lot of times the Vietnamese were fighting against Filipinos, Chinese were fighting against everyone. Like, you know, Koreans were fighting Japanese. I mean, they always fight each other, but you know, it was really intense, you know, and a lot of kids were dying. I lost a bunch of friends. Like, I've been shot at. Like, I'm in high school, you know, at that time, I thought I was a badass, you know? Like, I remember I was in seventh or eighth grade and I got my ear pierced, and we went to like a family function, you know? And looking back, like, I remember walking to my grandma's house with my ear pierced, like, what? Like, so gangster, right? And then, like, I walk in the house and everyone's like, oh, look at you, you got your ear pierced. Oh, my, all my uncle's like, oh, you think? And I'm like, oh, shut up. You know, and then, like, then my mom sees it. She's like, what the hell are you doing? And all my aunties are like, what are you doing with your ear pierced? And I'm like, And I remember getting yelled at in the kitchen, getting roasted by all my aunts and uncles about, they're like, oh, look at Dan, he got his ear. And then I realized, I'm like, damn, I'm not a gangster when I'm at my grandma's house. Hmm. I'm just this little kid. And they like took the earring out and everything. Like, wow, it was such a wake up call. But looking back at that time, I thought I was still grown because I had been through so much shit at 11 years old, you know? But looking back now, I'm like, damn, I could have died like so many times.
So many times, yeah.
And I wasn't listening to my parents' warnings because A, like I probably didn't have the capacity, and B, I don't think they were able to express it in that way, you know? I thought, because they were like, just go to school and then study, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, why can't I have fun? So to me, it was just like, I'm having fun. Like, why can't I have friends? Like, my friends are going to the mall afterwards and playing video games. Like, why can't I do that? But at that time, people were just getting shot all the time, dude. Asian kids were getting shot, and I was dressed like a gangster.
Yeah. You know? What year did you graduate high school?
2000.
2000.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that was 21
some years ago.
Tumultuous years. Yeah. Yeah, from, yes. I say from like 90, from 90 to 2000, or 90 to. Yeah, 90 to 2000. That decade was a brutal decade.
It was a brutal decade, man. Brutal, brutal. Like, I can't believe the infighting and the savagery of that time.
But for some people, that decade goes down in history for them, especially the ones that were college bound. There's no trace of it because that's not the life that they live. That's not their reality as a Vietnamese American at the time. You know, it was a clean, you know, high school. You know, if you were in Sunny Hills or Villa Park in Orange County, those schools are, you know, squeaky clean, you know, 4.3, 4.2 GPA motherfuckers. Yeah. And, you know, that's just the way that those people lived. And they went on to really take off and go to Harvard, you know, Ivy League schools, mm-hmm. and do a lot of shit.
I feel like they faced friction as well, because that's when the model minority stereotype was pushed on them, you know, like, oh, quiet Asian,
yeah,
go to school, you know, don't be loud, don't talk about your culture, like try to fit in, you know, have an American name, don't bring mamtom to mm-hmm. school for lunch, you know. And yeah, like that also propelled us on the gangster, the loud side too. Cause we were like, what the fuck? Like, we would always run around yelling Viet pride,
yeah,
and like be loud about being Vietnamese, you know? So like making, you know, having representation and shit. So it was a weird duality. Yeah.
Yeah. Those years, I think it was 94, 93, 94. I got the tattoo of Vietnam on my arm.
Vic. A lot of people during that year probably got
a lot of people.
Did you spell it in like caps and low caps, or is it just
one? And there's no yo.
Oh,
there's right. no yo. And when I look back up, you know, I think about it, you know, God, it's so embarrassing to talk about. But that's who you think you are. You think you fucking represent Vietnam, you know. And since that time to now, I can't tell you how many times I've thought about removing my tattoo.
Wow. That must have been a struggle.
I just recently, like in the last maybe 5 years, have come to terms with, no, you should probably leave it, because it's like a scar that is important to remind yourself that you're not. Not to remind myself that I'm Vietnamese, but to remind myself of the questions and the journey of not just being Vietnamese, but just fucking being a human being, and how it is our job to really question everything. You know, it's just our job. Artists or not, no artists. You're just, your job in life is to question everything and question the motivation, why we think the way we do, because going on to examine or living a life that's not examined is not, it's just why live it,
yeah.
Right? And now that I get to that point, I want to talk about the music that you listened to in the 90s that, because it relates to the work that you just put out. And here's where I want to ask, what I want to ask. I'm going to try to figure out how to ask you this. But at the time, there was a lot of West Coast, East Coast rap. There's a lot of kind of music going on at that in the 90s. Good music. Like there's, you know, our Vietnamese new wave. And then there's, you know, rap. And there's all kinds of grunge and, you know, stuff going on. How did all of that culminate in your life? How did you experience all that stuff during those years?
Yeah, that's a good question. It real quick about your Vietnamese tattoo. It's, you can't be mad at yourself at that time, because that's all we had. That's why we ran around saying Viet Pride. That's why we, you know, are like Viet Pride, because even the word not, that's from Vietnam, like that's all we had in America at that time, was each other and our Vietnamese heritage, you know. And even though it was limited of what we thought was Vietnamese, we really felt it, right? When you got that tattoo, you really felt you were Vietnamese, even though you didn't know, you know, the history of Saigon, or you didn't go live in Vietnam, like you felt Vietnamese as hell, you know. And I think that relates to that question of what does it mean to be Vietnamese.
I mean, so, did I feel Vietnamese, or did I feel lost and was looking for a buoy in the ocean that is called Vietnam, and I just needed something to hang on to because I was fucking lost as fuck, right? Like a lot of us, just yeah. lost, and you're just like, oh, yeah. I just need anything that's floating right now. I just need a flotation device in this fucking big ocean, so I can yeah. hold on to and not sink. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the fuck
makes
the
a lot of sense.
Yeah, I didn't know what the, you know, you just put a name on that flotation device.
Yeah. Wow. That was a lot of us. But yeah, so the music at that time, you know, growing up at that time, it's so interesting because I have my, like right when I'm talking about it, it's divided, right? I have my Asian gangster side during that time, and simultaneously my normal life. But there was no distinguishing between it. But when I talk about it now, I realize that, you know, when I'm with the other Vietnamese kids, the gangsters, it's one style. And then when I'm
yeah.
by myself, it's a different one. So of course I'm listening to grunge, hip hop, R&B, you know, a little bit of electronic stuff. Because my uncles were, you know, they got into raving before I did. And a little bit of Vietnamese new wave, but that stuff was really cheesy back then. It still is really cheesy. So I had to like dig through hundreds and hundreds of songs. And then on my gangster side, of course, there was Vietnamese rap at that time that came from mm-hmm. the gangs, you know? So that was the first, it's really interesting too, because one of the first Vietnamese rappers, Thai Viet G, was from this gang TRG, which was like a really big Vietnamese gang. And he put out this song, and it's called Vietnamese Gang, you know, Vietnamese gang that I fuck with, blah, 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 blah. Like, and that I remember that tape was being passed around. So we'd be all at, you know, the gangster crib ditching school. There was like 50 of us. And they're like, yo, man, check out this tape, man. And there's this Vietnamese guy rapping, and we're like, and he's actually good.
Good, so Ty like, was good.
Yeah, we're like, dang, this fool is sick. There was one other guy before him. I don't remember his name, but he put out a tape first, rapping over Ice Cube's Today Was a Good Day. And that tape was what started the whole Vietnamese rap thing. And then Thai Viet G came in after that, I think like 5 years after that. So, you know, we're listening to like Viet rap, like we're listening to freestyle, like Latin freestyle, like Debbie Deb, When I Hear Music, Stevie B. And we're listening to Vietnamese DJs. So
DJ Slim?
Yeah, and DJ Epic.
Epic.
Yes. Yes. So we would go to...
Wait, DJ Epic is... What was his real name?
Oh, I knew at a time. It was something like not Epic. It was like... I don't remember.
Where was he from?
He's from Santa Ana. He's from Little Saigon. So we would go to Orange County to Asian Garden Mall to Phuc La Tha, and we would go in the...
The music stores?
The music stores, but they're gift stores, like selling like stationery. And they would have bootleg CDs. So these are mixtape CDs from Vietnamese DJs in Saigon. And they had a little mixer there. So you can be like, yo, can you play this CD? And then, you know, the girl behind the ABG behind the counter would be like, yeah, sure. And then play the track and be like, oh, can you skip it? Oh, sick, sick. And then we'd buy the CD. Like, I found one of the CD covers in my storage, and I was like, so many memories, dude. So that was a huge movement too, you know, like Asian DJing. Like,
do you remember the Trilogy CDs by any chance?
Yes. Yes. That's the same era.
So that I put that out.
What?
I put that out, dude, with my partner.
Shut up.
Yeah. So that was a party.
What? Bro.
Yeah, so DJ Slim did those mixes for me and my partner's son. We threw parties in 94, 95, 96. We were Trilogy. It was me, my brother, son's brother, Scott, the four of us.
Oh, you were in the party scene?
I was
too?
In the party scene, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Oh, that era, bro. Oh
but you were, God. That's why I was asking what year you graduated high school so I can backtrack. Because if you graduated in the mid 90s, then chances are you, and if you were partying with, you know, TRG, NIP, you know, all those, you know, gangs at the time, they were shooting up our parties when we were doing these things. And
they were going to the parties.
They were going to our parties. And
Yeah,
it was a dangerous time. My mom and dad were like, Ken, you got to stop this. You know, but we were fucking making money. We were, at the time, we didn't know better. Man. But so I'm hearing you talk about this, you know, girl at the counter, the ABG girl, you know.
Oh, my God.
That we were literally bringing pressed bootleg DVDs to the thing, to these so distribution centers, you know.
Yeah, I think DJ Epic put out a CD with Slim.
Yeah.
I think they did a couple CDs together.
So I'm trying to wonder if Tanasi Tran is DJ Epic. And I'm so sorry, Tanasi, if I'm getting this wrong.
No, I don't think
Tony.
I remember.
Because Tony. Yeah.
He had a Vietnamese name.
Yeah. I don't know if it's Tony, but. Or Mystic. Was Tony Mystic?
No,
or?
Yeah. Mystic was a different guy.
Yeah, but Slim and I were very close. We, you know, I happened to live in San Diego at the time because I was a Marine. It was like my second year in the Marine Corps. And, you know, my partner and I, son, both of our brothers were coming back, and we used to party in high school and stuff together, the four of us. And then both of our brothers went away for different reasons. You know, my brother was in the Marine Corps coming back from Japan. His brother was coming back. And so the four of us were like, oh, dude, we should throw a house party. Son's parents had a pretty fat house in the Anaheim Hills, and we got together and we're like talking about like, okay, Tom gets home this time, Scott gets home this time. It's just, and then we started to make a guest list, and there was like 500 people on the fucking guest list, and we're like, wait a minute, all these raves are going on, fuck it, let's go print flyers. So he and I decided to go print like 5,000 flyers, and we were literally going to Phuc La Tha and putting them in cars. And that was like the kickoff of that shit. That time was, we're like, all right, it's going to be, and then 2,000 people showed up to the first party, and it could only hold like 500, that lobby. I think it was like a Holiday Inn lobby. It was crazy, man. Yeah. And that was the kickoff. And years later, you know, we were in competition with Nostalgia, which is the guys that threw the Shark Club. you know, Vietnam over there. So yeah, it was a rowdy scene, man. It was fun and it was rowdy and great times. But I want to hear your experience now, during those years.
I can't believe that, dude. That's so sick, man.
This is the first time I've talked about it, I think, on these episodes.
Bro, that's Asian American, that's Vietnamese American history right there, bro. Because during that time, like, we were all throwing parties,
yeah,
and going to parties, printing flyers out, putting them on cars, passing them out. Like, that whole era was so important for Vietnamese Americans.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of our first identity outside of gangsters, you know, even though, you know, we were gangsters in proximity and gangsters went to our party, but so did everyone else. You know, everyone snuck out of their house to go to the party. And wow, there's so much knowledge and little nuances in there, dude. I really want to do some sort of project, archival project on that era for sure. Like I did with the V-Wave thing, but yeah, during that time, like, I was throwing parties, my friends were throwing parties. That's how I started DJing, was in that sort of like style, that environment. So it was like Eurodance, high energy, you know, like house remixes, you know. So that's the stuff that I started playing. And then later on, I moved into like hip hop and turntablism and stuff. But yeah, that era defined so much for us, you know, like, it was super important. But yeah, so, you know, myself during that era, I was like throwing parties, going to the parties. I was like, what, 15, 14? Again, it was so normal. Now, when I think about it, I cannot imagine.
My 15-year-old going to, yeah.
Hell no.
Some 15-year-old go, yeah.
Hell no, you're on TikTok, bro. Like, you stay on, you're staying home on TikTok or play some games. Like, what, you know, like, I cannot imagine. Like, I don't have kids, but yeah, if my 15-year-old, no way. Like, it was wild.
Yeah.
I can't believe we did that, dude. But you know, everything at that time was more raw. Like, it was more politically incorrect, more dangerous, more exciting. Like, everything, things now I feel are a little bit more streamlined, but at that time we were still figuring out who we were and what to do with our lives, you know? So,
but yeah. You know, is that I wonder, I'm not trying to put good or bad on it, but isn't that like, when I think about, and I always ask this question to people who come on, you know, because of that rawness, we have all this material to talk about, you know? And like, if I was doing this this show 20 years from now, and I was interviewing kids that were like coming up around this time and they're in their 30s or 40s, and they're like, you know, we were on TikTok, right? We're just chilling at home on TikTok all the day, or IG, or remember when we were fucking on Minecraft, and you know, you were in that room with me. You know, it's all this digital shit that they don't get to go out and. But I don't want to be that old man going, oh man, fucking back in my day. You know, fuck all that. I want to figure out how, though, is this new way that we're living. Do we go back to it? Are we gonna go back to it somehow? Or can we go back to that rawness somehow? Or our kids, are they gonna be going through that same weird rawness that we went through, but in a different way? Or is it gone? Or is this shit like smooth from now on? And it's just, their struggles are just different. I'm just curious about it.
Yeah, their struggles are different because. Yeah, I think for, you know, humans, we're constantly redefining ourselves.
Yeah.
And so is society, you know, peeling back the layers. So I would like to believe that they still have their own rawness and their own struggles. It's just painted in a different way.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd like to believe, but who knows?
Like, what are their struggles going to be, you know? It's going to be interesting.
There's probably a lot. Like, there's a lot of identity things. Like, our systems right now are getting restructured, which is super awesome, you know? Like, the old systemic fucking drama is getting brought to light, you know? That's really, it's really dope. Like, I feel like we have a voice now, whereas before, like, you know, like in high school, college, like, I had a huge kind of like anarchist phase as well. I was very angry about the Vietnam War. super pissed about the war. I was super pissed about the government. I went to so many protests, like did so much stuff, you know, but like, I feel like we weren't really heard, you know, at that time we were protesting the Gulf War. We were protesting Palestine. We were protesting like whale products in makeup. Like we were protesting so much shit all the time, dude. And I feel like it kind of made a dent, but now I feel like, yo, you can just hop online and be like, you know, fuck the government. And then like, there's momentum. Like, dude, so much has changed in the last year, 2 years for Asian Americans, you know, the BLM movement, like the whole, like, you know, recognizing, you know, that some cops are dirty, like all those things, I feel like just got
amplified,
you know, blown up to that amplified. Yeah. But that could have been, who's to say that, that like, we probably played a role in that too, all these years to finally get to this level now. So,
well, that's a good point you make, because there's this new book called Rise, you know, Jeff Yang.
Oh, I seen it. Yeah.
New York Times bestseller now. And I always felt like I was kind of sleeping on the, at the wheel, right, with the shit. And now being in such close proximity with the, you know, the people that are, you know, in the trenches, like Ma Nguyen, or, you know, running into Jeff Yang and Feel You at over at Angry Asian Man. I feel like I know nothing. And now, I have a copy. I ordered a copy of the book on Amazon for supporting. I wanted to support, and I cracked the book open and I was blown the fuck away. The table of contents is like what we're talking about. It's like a chapter, subchapters of the breakdowns of all of the things that were monumental. And it's broken down into sort of like these time periods where you could see like the Asian American struggle unfold by reading the tape. Just the table of contents will rock you. Yeah. So it's a thick book. And I think everybody should pick up that book, because just like the history of the people's history of the U.S., this is definitely a book that I think people in our space definitely need to read. Asian American, you have to read this book. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot of reviews from it, and some of my friends are in it too. And it's just like, yes. Like,
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs, so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Feel seen, you know?
Yeah. V-pop, or not V-pop, V-Wave. Tell me about the project and the inspiration for the project.
So I grew up, you know, in a house with like 14 people. Like my older cousins who were like 18 at the time, older uncles and cousins like lived there. And that's probably where I got my music education in the beginning. Like they would play all types of music, like rap, you know, classic rock, which at that time wasn't that classic, you know, pop, you know, Vietnamese new wave. But they were like, they were rowdy, you know, they weren't like, they just came from Vietnam. They're like exploring their identity as well. They, now that I think about it, they kind of went through their own rowdy gangster phase, but it wasn't gang related. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just all the refugees who just came band together. That was their era. So in that community, they're passing around tapes. Like, so what they would do is one person would save up, or I mean, they would all save up and they would buy a boombox. So between like 10, 15 people, there'd be one boombox. And each week that boombox would stay at a different person's house. And then everyone would band together and buy one tape, one CD or whatever it was. And then they would make copies. So their party was like, okay, who has a boombox this week? Oh, Gao Tang has it. Let's go to that house. And in that house, there was 15, 20 people, like every single Vietnamese house, because refugees were still coming over and the people here were sponsoring them over. So they would have them like stay at the house for like a month or something until they got on their feet. Like my grandparents were still doing that up until like, you know, like 2000s, like they were still bringing people over and helping them out, sponsoring them and stuff. So, you know, so in that little ecosystem, like a bunch of tapes were passed around, bunch of Viet Wave, like all types of stuff. So, you know, I got my music education growing up. They're like, oh yeah, this is new wave, this is punk, this is post-punk, blah blah. Like I remember singing like Tears for Fears, like really loud and stuff, and like, you know, so they gave me that education. So then, you know, fast forward to like gangster years, I kind of like shy away from that because a lot of it was just really corny, like cha-cha-cha stuff, covers and stuff. And then when I got to college, I was like, oh yeah, hey, I remember these tapes that my uncles like left me. And I remember some of them were kind of good. Let me, because when I got into college is when I got super nerdy into DJing, like 18, 19. I started digging for like, that's when my journey of like music historian started. Like I was really into like rare funk and soul from like the States and from London and stuff. So we would go to like record stores in the middle of the desert and like dig in there and be like, yo, can we go into your back room? Cause every record store, vinyl store has a back room where they only let, you know, either the employees come in or like real diggers. Like, so the term for people who dig for music are crate diggers, are they're just called diggers. So our dusty fingers, because going through all the records, you would get super dusty. So, you know, so at that time, so I was like, oh dude, I got these Vietnamese tapes. So I went through all the tapes and like, there was probably like 20, 25 tapes. Most of them are trash, but there was like three or four songs that were like, whoa, these songs are kind of dark. They're kind of serious. Like they're not like the ha ha cha cha cha. They're like, you know, like, oh, like riding at night type of music. And I'm like, yo, I need to find more of this stuff. So after that, I started going to the tape store, the bootleg stores in Santa Ana, asking them, because at that time, New Wave has already passed. You know, this is like 2001, 2002. Everyone's moved on to like Laserdisc and like, you know, Paris by Night, more Paris by Night stuff, you know? So I would go to these stores in Santa Ana and be like, yo, do you have any old boxes of like New Wave tapes, you know? And most of the time, no. But once in a while, there'd be some stuff and I just like, and that became, I became obsessed with that. You know, we'd visit our cousins in Denver. I'd be like, to all the Zhu and you know, all the aunties and uncles, like, hey, do you guys have any old tapes from this era that, you know, you're about to throw away? And a lot of times they did. They're like, oh yeah, we got this box. We're gonna give it away, but you know, we never, here, you can have it. I'm like, oh my God. So I would get vinyl, tapes, CDs. You know, I would like, online there was nothing, but once in a while, every like 5 or 6 years, someone would find one of those tapes and upload the tracks onto YouTube at like a really low quality. So I would hit them up. So this whole journey started because I was like, first I was like, I remember there's good Vietnamese music. Second is when I started DJing a lot, I wanted to play Vietnamese music, but there was no Vietnamese music. Like music from Vietnam at that time was super corny. It was just love songs and things like that, you know? And it still kind of is, just like, not now anymore, but for a long time, it was just basic stuff. So then I started digging, but playing them on you know, club systems, they're really low quality. So then I had to remaster, re-edit them, make them stronger. There was a couple of like cheesy parts. I took it out. Like I enhanced the bass, like put in more drums, things like that. So that's been going on for like 10, 15 years, just like digging, re-editing. And then, you know, when I was digging, then I started thinking about these labels and these artists. I'm like, hey, like, where are these people now? You know, so then I started hunting labels down. I started talking to people, getting little tidbits from like the record store owners. And it just became like, this thing that I always did. Every time I went somewhere to another country on tour, DJing or anything like that, or doing my artwork stuff, if I went into a music shop that was Vietnamese, I would ask them about V-Wave. I'd be like, yo, you guys remember this era, blah, blah, blah. And they'd be like, yeah, I remember that. And then I would just, you know, like a student, like soaking it up, you know. And that journey continues now to this day, you know. I still try to learn about it and like highlight that era, because for us, you know, me and you, like our thing was like gangsters or the party scene, the rave scene. But for the generation before us, yeah, this was what their way of coming together. And, you know, we were yelling Viet Pride, they were yelling New Wave, you know. So it's just, it's the same thing.
I always ask people of that generation, like, what is it about that music? Because it's like, what, Italo disco or, you know, Euro disco? Why that music and not Echo and the Bunnymen or Tears for Fears or OMD or, you know, Joy Division? Why did it have to be specifically Modern Talking, Bad Boys Blue, Fancy, CC Catch, Sandra? You know, why does it have, why was that sound specific to the Vietnamese youth generation of that time?
I think that, you know, OMD, Depeche Mode, like Tears for Fears, it was part as well. Like, you know how we talked about in the 90s, there was gangsters and then there's the students. So that's how it was in the New Wave time. There was Modern Talking kids and then the Tears for Fears kids. You know, so that's what I'm highlighting in my V-Wave stuff. It's like the darker, more edgier, because that's what I grew up. That's what my uncles were. You know, they'd fight all the time. They'd fight racist kids all the time. Like, it was like a thing, you know, like, oh, look, there's some racist white dudes, you know, they yell out some fucking slurs and my cousin would run over and there'd be a big old fight, you know, and then they'd bump Tears for Fears afterwards. And I'm just like, you guys are so cool, you know. So that's from my learnings and talking with everyone. That's how I saw it too. Like the, you know, the Italo disco stuff, it's very happy, it sounds great,
it's very simple,
and it's very simple.
You know? I mean, you drift into the OMD stuff, that's a little bit more, that's simple, but like Tears for Fears or, you know, Depeche Mode, I mean, the lyrics are piercing. So much exactly. Layers, Erasure, you know, all of that stuff. But yeah, it's just I had cousins who are, you know, that you're talking about, the Jews and the uncles, but they were older cousins, and you know, these guys are in their 50s now, but they didn't listen to the Tears for Fears and Depeche Mode. And I'm wondering, was it a language sophistication thing that they couldn't understand, because it was just, you know, jump in my car is jump in my car, and it's not, you right. know, Black Celebration, right? It's
right.
they're just different,
they had a big part.
Different levels of English that you can digest differently.
Yeah, and I also think it's where what they were exposed to probably as well. Like maybe because the stuff on the radio at that time was, they played everything on the radio. So I think it really depends like what they gravitated towards, but definitely more gravitated towards the Italo disco, Modern Talking, yeah, talking stuff for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I still bump that stuff too, driving.
Yeah, me yeah. too.
So, all right. So this V-Wave. So what exactly is the project? Is it a documentary? Is it just a series of collected music that you remastered to boost, to make it stronger? What is it?
Yeah, it's a music archival project. So the music is the focus. So I'm trying to bring to light these forgotten tracks, but they're not just tracks from that era. They're like tracks that I curated in the sense where I had to dig through hundreds and hundreds of different songs to come up with this certain like mood. So it's like a mixtape kind of mood. So the mood in the songs, like they're all like a little bit more somber. And, you know, in releasing them, I have to, you know, like kind of give context to people who aren't familiar with the movement, you know? So that's when I started like writing out the stuff, like just so people can, like, who's not familiar with it, just get a really brief history lesson to listen to it. And yeah, so it started as, you know, more people need to hear these songs. They're so good. Because I was looking for years for Vietnamese music like this. And, you know, like, I couldn't find it, you know? And then I was like, oh crap, like, this, I had this in my childhood. So now, like, playing this music, like, so many Vietnamese Americans and Vietnamese people are like, whoa, this is, like, we didn't even know this existed. And a lot of people are taking, they feel Vietnamese when they listen to it, you know? And that's, I just want to preserve the culture, you know, but put out bangers. And, you know, like, so this is, it's an ongoing project. I'm going to drop part two probably pretty soon, which has, you know, more songs, and I'm just going to keep doing it until I run out of songs. So,
and do you have to get permission from the label or from the singer?
Yeah. So, I hit up the labels, the original labels. So this is another reason why it took so long to drop, because the labels were disappeared for so long, and now they're starting to reemerge here and there. So it's a little bit easier to find them and get clearance for them from them now.
So do you have to, I mean, is it a profit sharing thing, or is it just an art project basically?
Yeah, I'm doing all this out of my pocket, and it's released for free. You can just go and download it for free, and the labels are okay with that. I got permission from them to do that. So, because they're happy that it's going out there again, and it also brings attention back to the original artists, you know, cause I'm like, here's these remixes, people listen to them. They're like, oh my God, they're going to go search for the original artist. They're going to search for the label, you know? So it's like a win-win situation for everyone.
Hey, you know, man, you know, what's really crazy is, Super Bowl a few years ago, I was sitting and I was sitting in the living room with a few of my friends, and they're like, oh, you should hear, it was 2 days after the Super Bowl, and they were like, oh, you should hear this song, you're really gonna like it, blah blah blah. And they played The Weeknd, Save Your Tears, right? And I heard it, and I was like, wait a minute, that shit, that sound is what we grew up on. You know, the synthesizers, the yeah, way that he wrote the music feels like this guy, this artist, The Weeknd, lived through our time when we were young kids. Yeah. It's oddly familiar. And I haven't had a chance to really talk about it on this podcast, but you know, it's so reminiscent of you know, that new wave era for us. The way the song is put down, the way the verses and the chorus mesh together and flow, it's like this young guy lived through, you know, this music 25 years ago and kind of brought this experience back, and it's in our collective sort of like audio genetics that we are re-experiencing. And I think about that. I'm like, how did he get this? Did he listen to Italo disco of that era? Because there's nothing else like it.
Well, actually, so
maybe I don't know.
No, you're totally right. Because you're totally right about him bringing it back. But it exists, like, in the 2000s, when it all kind of died out of the mainstream. There was still a niche. There still is nowadays a niche group that makes that sound. So these are, like, you know, musicians and producers all over the world. They're not necessarily Vietnamese, but it's called like synth pop, synth wave, 80s synth pop. So that kind of continued to grow. So if you want, you can like find a bunch of artists with that style, but The Weeknd definitely brought it to the mainstream. Wow. So that whole album he has is like producers. Some of the producers are from that era. Some of them are just new kids that, you know, studied that style and we did it. But I agree, the way he did it, and that is like,
but you, perfect. You can't make that music without knowing about what happened in the '90s, in the early '90s, or the '80s. You can't create the layers, because I've watched videos on like how other people have, like, okay, let me show you how to break this down on a synth level. I've watched videos on how they layer these things, and I'm like, you can't know that sound. You just can't come up with it in the year 2020, 2019 and just come up with this shit and produce that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you have to study it. You have to have someone from that era because there's little nuances.
Yes.
Just like any genre, you know, so it's like a genre, like a it's like a period piece, right? Like you have to write it this way, layer it that way and stuff. But dude, it's, he brought the public consciousness to new wave sound. So, you know, it's so wild.
It's like, wild. It's wild. Yeah. It's so wild. And then my friends are like, you never heard of The Weeknd? I'm like, I've seen The Weeknd. I've seen The Weeknd, but he's black, right? He's black. And you know, I never associated before that Super Bowl weekend, I never associated The Weeknd and some shit that I grew up on. I just, you know, it just, I was like, all right. Oh my God. When I heard it, I was like, this guy just took us back to the 90s, the late 80s, you know, and that Save Your Tears is breathtaking. Yeah. When I got to hear it.
And I think that song also like helped new wave, like my stuff, like be more accessible to certain people as well, you know? So that's, yeah, it's interesting timing.
Now, when a project like V-Wave comes up for you and you're inspired and you're motivated to do it, what are sort of like the drivers for you? I mean, it doesn't sound like it's financial incentives, but what kind of like marks are you leaving behind, or what's your thought process to say, you know what, I'm going to dedicate a big chunk of my fucking time to attack this?
It's actually... the music, like every time I listen to it, I get goosebumps. I'm like, I can't believe Joe and Yi were doing this in the 80s, dude. Like, what the hell? Like, I can't believe my Vietnamese aunties and uncles were wearing shoulder pads, playing these synths, hitting these drums. And I'm like, what? And listening to the music, I'm just like, I still get goosebumps, you know? I'm like not bored of it. Like, I listen to the music, I'm like, dude, this is so good. It would be a travesty to just keep this to myself or just to play it in my gigs. I have to release this. Vietnamese people have to know about this. Like, it's a Viet Pride thing, you know? Like, when I play it, I'm like, Viet Pride! And I'm like, oh God, other Vietnamese people would probably love this stuff too, because we're still figuring out our identity, you know? Like, still, and also this is such an important part of Vietnamese American heritage. Like, we have to hear this. So that drives me. And then when I get, because I'm, you know, when I get burnt out, or like, because I have a million projects going on, when I feel like I don't have time for it, you know, I'm not making any money, like I'm not trying to get my name out there in that way, like I listen to the music and I get pumped just from listening to the tracks, and I'm like, okay, let's fucking go. And then I write the, you know, then I start doing the work. So it's driven by the music first and foremost, and then it's driven by, I feel like this can enrich Vietnamese people's lives when they listen to it. Like, and so far it has been doing that. I've been getting messages from Vietnamese people all over the world, and they're like, I cried when I listened to this, or like, finally I feel seen, or like, you know, I played this for my parents and we cried together, or like, you know, like even messages from like, yeah, like, you know, Vietnamese kids who grew up detached from Vietnamese culture. And they're like, wow, finally, like there's a cool Vietnamese, like, you know, even people in Vietnam are like, what the hell is this? Like, cause in Vietnam, like they know about modern talking like here and there, but no one, like, because V-Wave was kind of banned in Vietnam in the 90s, you know, because Vietnam was kind of like,
closed off,
like, you know, they're limiting American stuff, so not a lot of kids knew about it. So, but yeah, it's driven by it, the music needs to get out, you know, it needs to go out there. So yeah, I literally listen to the songs before I work on the stuff.
How can we find it?
It's on Bandcamp right now for free. So you can just Google Demon Slayer, V-Wave, or the actual address is vwave.bandcamp.com.
Now, how did you come up with
that? If you just Google it.
How did you come up with the name Demon Slayer?
It started kind of as a joke between me and three of my friends. Like in 2002, we started a clothing company, and it was like, the imagery was like heavy metal, goth, like punk, dark stuff, but with a twist of like comedy. So, you know, it'd be like black metal, like a horse's skeleton, but it's like a unicorn or something. So we're combining like dark, harsh imagery with like a little bit of humor. So we figured Demon Slayer is a funny name because it sounds like very metal, but it's also kind of a joke. So we did the clothing for like 5 or 6 years. It got really big. You know, it did well. A bunch of people wore it. We made really cool stuff. And then we kind of just disbanded. And then I remember I had a show coming up. I was called Ill Kid Panda before that. And I was like, oh, I'll just use the name Demon Slayer because everyone's calling us that, you know? So, and then it just kind of grew into its own.
What year was that?
2004, maybe.
So was that
2004?
I understand that that's like an anime, right? Now
it's an anime. Yeah, the anime just came out like a year or two ago.
So you were way before the anime.
Yeah, I was like way before the anime. Yeah. Now I'm like, damn, my SEO is all fucked up now. Like, you search Demon Slayer and it's just the anime comes up. But
did they ever?
I don't care. You know?
Did they ever come after you?
No, they haven't. But it's funny because a lot of people ask me about the anime now, and sometimes I'm like, I don't watch the anime, but it's a good anime. It's pretty legendary. But I struggled with keeping the name for a while. I wanted to change it because, you know, I was painting murals for the city of Riverside. I was in the arts council of like cities and stuff. And, you know, I would be walking to the presentation and it's all these like dudes in suits and they'll be like, and next we have Demon Slayer. And, you know, they're all like, what? And I'm like, Dan Nguyen, everybody, you know? So I thought about changing it, but I realized it's about slaying the inner demons, you know? So you know, I embraced it now. It's like your Vietnamese tattoo, you know? It was like a scar, but now it's like, it's about slaying your inner demons and, you know, self-awareness and
so interesting.
Who you are, you know?
Yeah. These layers that happen as we go in living.
Yeah. And my family has a long history of like spiritual, supernatural stuff too, you know? So that I realized that tied in a lot to it. So I have this whole wild, like supernatural side that's intense, you know? So yeah, a lot of weird experiences.
I'm beginning to see that pop up more and more as I do this work. It's just showing up a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Like that, like stuff that happens to people, like
in our culture, in our Vietnamese culture.
Totally.
Even beyond it, it's, you know, I think that it's always been there. And I'm just the guy that has not paid attention to it. So I'm beginning to get awakened and seeing all of it. And, you know, I don't know how much I believe. I don't know how much faith I have in this sort of like, is it real? Is it not real? But I'm seeing so much more of it. And when you start talking to people, you realize like a lot of these stories date back generations. And they continue to happen. Like whatever experience that you're going to be talking about, I want to ask you, you know, whatever weird or strange things that you've experienced, that's modern day, right? But there's like a linear progression of like, connective tissue.
It is. And it's like our DNA too, you know? It's like Vietnam has a traumatizing past, you know, and I think some of it we take with us, you know, but yeah.
It's trippy. It's a very trippy thing. And when are you expected to go back to Vietnam?
It's opened up now, but I'm going to chill for a little bit and see how it goes, how stable it is, you know, for it to come back and stuff. So, but probably in a few months. Like I'm in my life, like I want to always have 1 foot in Vietnam, 1 foot in the States. So whereas before I was living in Vietnam and then coming back to the States for touring and other projects, now I think I'm going to stay here and then, you know, spend like 3 months in Vietnam, like, you know, 5 months in Vietnam out of the year. So
it's weird because I have friends now that are doing that, guys who've been there for 10 years, 12 years, and they all come back here. What is that?
I think it just depends on different people. Sometimes people just, you know, they get tired of it. They're American, like born here, go back there, and, you know, you're like, America might still be home to them, you know, maybe they just might have felt like they've been away for a while in Vietnam. But when I was in Vietnam living there, I feel like that was my home. I was like, I don't think I'm ever going back to America. Yeah. And then it would change. Then I'm like, America's not so bad. And then it would just go back and forth. And then now I feel love for both places, like equally, you know. So surprisingly, home can be two places, I've come to understand.
That's what they say about having two wives.
Oh, yeah.
Just fucking with you.
Oh, at the same time?
Yeah.
Oh.
My mom said that to me about the older generation, you know?
Oh, yes. Oh, that was such a big thing for that era.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Wife in Vietnam. I just thought
I'd fuck with you. But yeah, my mom said that to me once. Yeah. She goes, yeah, yeah. Don't underestimate sort of like that division of your concentration and your love, because men have loved deeply both of their wives, you know. It is a possibility. Yeah, and it is
a possibility. Yeah,
our human nature is very, you know, it's fuzzy math.
Yes, dude, especially when it comes to love, you know, there's no logic.
Yeah,
there.
So yeah, I prepared a lot of questions for you and I don't think I got through four of them. I'm looking at my question list right now and I'm like, I didn't get through anything, and it's time to hop off because I know you have a hard stop. But nonetheless, I think, you know, oftentimes when I prepare these guests, these list questions, I'm so much more thrilled to go about this organically and just have the questions as a fallback guide, you know, sort of my insurance policy, right? Because what's happening in real time is much more important than what you prepped in your brain to go forward, right? It's like, fuck that.
Totally.
Yeah, it's like we have this idea going into a project, what we think it'll be. But goddamn, when we get there, it's like, wait, this is totally different. This is on some other level. Yeah.
Yeah, we get inspired in different ways.
The ways, yeah, yeah.
I can go to like 3:10 to like 20 more minutes.
Yeah.
Get in some more questions.
Yeah, I have like one or two more questions that I really wanted to get into. You talked about the mood of the songs, and it sounds, you've brought that up a lot, like a vibe, a mood. There's so much to be explored in that way of thinking. And I always wonder, is there sort of like a criteria, or if there's some sort of structure or some, God, I asked this question just yesterday, 2 days ago with another scenario, and somebody was just like, Ken, stop it. Stop putting structure to, you know, this art. But I had to fire back. I had to challenge that. I'm like, I am just a person who doesn't know about your space. So I'm just trying to make logic and make sense of the way that you've constructed this. So that's my question to you with the V-Wave curation. Is there any way you can quantify or qualify what you kind of put together?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a, like, because V-Wave at that time, for so many people like our age, it was our parents' music or uncle's music, and a lot of it was corny. Most of it was corny. So the first, you know, qualifier for the track is it corny or not?
Okay, let's stop there. What do you define as corny?
Maybe like very bright, very happy, talking about just like The mood, okay, so maybe it's the mood instead of corny. I didn't want like very happy, joyful, like, hey, like running in the rainbows type of music. I wanted something, first I was playing this for the club. So I wanted something like, and my personal taste with music anyways is a little bit more like somber, slightly melancholy. The Weeknd's track is a really good example, right? It's upbeat, it's fast, it's bright sounding, but when you listen to it, it's a little bit like, it's a little moody, like it's like a sunset drive. It's not like running in the beach, like, well, actually it is a little bit.
No. So, I think I agree with the first part. It's not, there's a lot of minor chords in it. The major chords are sort of just there to kind of hold the song up, but he does get into that. There's quite a bit of minor chords, and you kind of feel the dark and the pain of what he's describing.
Bit, yeah, you feel the contemplation, you know, of in the sound. So that was the first one. So going through all these tracks, I'm like, okay, does it fit the mood or not? So it's like when a DJ prepares songs for the night, it's called programming. So I'm programming a set, I'm programming the journey that I want to take people on. So maybe I want to start kind of happy and then go into like something dark and then go up to something exciting. So I curated the songs in that sense too. So the first thing was like, is it a little bit somber, a little bit slightly melancholy in the lyrics or in the mood? Yes, okay. Second part, is there Vietnamese in it? Like, because a lot of these covers are all English, or they just have one verse in Vietnamese and the rest are in English. And I'm like, is there Vietnamese lyrics? Yes, okay. And third, which is probably the most important one, is it a banger? Like, is there nice drums? Can you dance to this? Or can you like, because I'm really like, I come from hip hop and like bass music and you know, electronic music. So I need that like, I need that slap. I need that like, ooh, listen to those. Wow, this is a really strong beat. Like it's the beat, you know? So yeah, so that's pretty much the three qualifiers. And also, you know, what do the lyrics talk about? Is it just another like love song? If it is, like, does it sound cool in Vietnamese? Like, you know, since I'm archiving old stuff, like the quality is a huge thing. Most of the songs are really low quality, but some are like too low to even save. So yeah.
And what is the process of you remastering? Like, do you add more stuff to it or do you just lift up the structure?
So it depends on the song. Like, if there's a lot of frequency, a lot of chunks missing, like, you know, perhaps like you can't hear the bass anymore, then I'll add a bass to it, but I'll add a bass where it's not evasive, where it doesn't sound like, oh, hey, Dan added a modern bass line. Like, I'm just trying to supplement what's already there. So I'm trying to retain the integrity of the song, but just boost it up. So I try not to add stuff. If I do, it's like little things that you can't notice just to like reinforce the song. And I rearrange a lot of the parts where the beats are like stronger. So in all of the tracks on the V-Wave tape, they're all like rearranged. If you hear the original, it won't sound like that. It's like, you know, maybe I took a drum break at the end and I put it in the beginning and like looped it twice, so there's like a really strong intro. Wow. Or like there's a part where they sing in English but it sounds kind of like unpleasant, so then I'll take that part out and replace it with the Vietnamese part, you know. Or like sometimes I'll take the English part out completely and just leave the Vietnamese part, you know.
So how I understand music is when you're sitting in the studio and you're looking at the screen, there's different tracks, right? There's different drum tracks and vocal tracks. But
yeah,
you're not getting those tracks broken down. You're just getting one lump pre-mixed already in one thing. How do you take out, how do you separate music with...
So Yeah, that's a good question. So those tracks are called stems. So there's no stems in this. They're just, you know, one track that I probably got from a tape cassette that's distorted, wobbly. So the process is long. So generally in music and engineering, you don't take a crappy track and boost it up. That's a big no-no, because that crappy track, it's missing frequencies. So you can't replicate those frequencies. You can't find those old frequencies
right.
anymore, but you can like replicate them to trick the ear into thinking that they're there. So doing that, like for instance, one process, it's different with every song, but one song, like I'll take that one song, I'll separate it into four or five frequencies, like sub bass, bass, mid, mid high, and then high. And then I like EQ and tune each of those things. Then I put them back into one thing, and then like possibly add stuff to that one thing. And then I go and like master it. So it's a really lengthy process. And that's probably why it took so like 10 years for this tape to come out, because
I kept looking
for new songs, and two, each song, it was so painful to put out.
Wow.
It was really hard. So I had a bunch of engineer friends help me with that, and like mastering friends as well. So yeah.
I had no idea you worked on it for that long, 10 years.
Yeah, 15, 10 years. Like I started digging the songs and started editing them in like 2010. I started digging for the songs earlier because I grew up with them, but in 2010 was when I started playing them out and like remastering them.
Okay. There's so much, like I said, there's so much about your life, because you're just not a musician person. You're no musician artist. You're, you know, you paint and you do murals and you do a lot more things than we even touched upon. I think we only probably touched about 20% of the work that you've done.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that I wanted to ask you about is your Coachella experience. I understood that you got an experience at Coachella. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I actually played there twice.
Wow.
So once in 2015 and once in 2019. Yes, 19. And 2019 was probably the most wild one, because it was there was like thousands of people, and they had asked me to perform, because a lot of the bookers and event people in Coachella like grew up in SoCal, in LA, Riverside, the IE, the Inland Empire, you know? So they were already privy to my work as an artist, as a musician, as a DJ, like even before I left to Vietnam. So, you know, like I was always on the radar, and then, you know, they hit me up. I'm like, of course I would want to play, you know? So it was intense. It was the whole weekend I was there, I didn't really absorb the fact that I was playing Coachella. It was just kind of like, all at once, you know, I was on a golf cart, like going from stage to stage. And like, it was just like, I was at work. I didn't have time to process it. And then I played Coachella, and the next day I had a flight to Vietnam. So I played, I went back to LA, packed all my stuff. The next day I was on a flight flying to Vietnam. And when I was sitting on the plane is when I realized like, oh crap, I just played the biggest festival in America. Like, what the heck? And then I thought my life would change after that, you know? Like, I don't have to work anymore. Like, you know, I'm just gonna get $1 million gigs all the time. And no, nothing changed. Well, I mean, yeah, stuff changed, but you know, you like in my career as a DJ producer, like I've just been used to doing things like with the flow. Like I didn't set out, like I being a DJ and an artist was just to share music and to express myself. That's how I express myself. I didn't intend to like make it or whatever. I didn't intend to be like, okay, my goal is to play Coachella, or my goal is to achieve this, you know, because I was happy to just be able to play. Because growing up, you know, my parents and society, everyone's like, no music, no art. So me sustaining a career through art or music, I feel like I already made it. So I never really thought like, oh, I want to play Coachella, or I want to achieve for that. Now it's different. Now I'm like, okay, I'm able to create for a living. What's my trajectory? what am I doing with this talent, with this life? Like, how am I here to help people? You know, that's my goal now. Like, how do I enrich the world with what I'm doing? What's my purpose, you know? But before that, like, so that's why when Coachella came, I was like super excited. I was like, oh wait, is my life supposed to change after this? And then it kind of did, but the experience itself was eye-opening, and people received it well. Like, I didn't think anyone cared, but like a lot of people in Vietnam took a lot of pride in that, because, you know, I'm from Vietnam. I'm basically Vietnamese there, and them seeing me on stage playing Vietnamese music, you know, I played V-Wave during my Coachella set. I also played a lot of current Vietnamese artists as well.
Wow.
Because, you know, I do that in all my sets, you know, so seeing that was like,
wait, has there ever been any Vietnamese artists that played at Coachella?
Yeah, so there was what's her name? Tao and the Get Down. Tao and the Jump Up Get Down. It's a San Francisco band. She played in 2015 or something. But outside of that, everyone's been saying I'm the first Vietnamese producer DJ to play. And I haven't really searched all the lineups, but some people have, and I guess they say I'm the first Vietnamese person to play. So if that's true, that's pretty dope. And
I love your approach I love your modest approach to answering questions, because it's just fucking keeping shit real, you know? Yeah. You're just like, well, I don't know. You know, this is what I've heard, but, you know, I'm not sure. And I love that, man.
Yeah, thanks, man. I've learned to stay humble, dude, because I've had times where I wasn't humble, and that just hit me in the face, you know, and I almost quit after that. You know, when you start to believe your own hype, that's, for me, that's,
you're fucked.
You're fucked, because that's what happened to me. Like, when I first got my first taste of fame, like in like 2005, 2006, I was like, oh my God, like, I'm awesome, you know? And then I think I kind of became a little too like cocky for like a few months. And then I realized, like, yo, that's, it can go at any moment. Like, what I have now is a blessing, you know? Like, my fingers could get chopped off tomorrow. I can go blind, you know? So like, you know, it's fleeting, you know? So my thing is always just to stay present, be appreciative for what you have, but stay fucking hungry, you know? And other people that I've met who are advanced on their journey, who are like super popping or famous or successful, they're the most humble people I know. Like, the most humble, it's wild. But kids who just got the fame, like, most of the time the first wave of fame makes people really cocky, because we don't know how to deal with it. It's like when people win the lottery and they don't have money management, you know, they just do they just spend it all at once. So
and there's also this like weird, like, you know, when you're young and you get all this the accolades and the write-ups, and you don't really know that there's a fucking lifetime more of shit that you're gonna have to learn. Right? There's like, right, so, dude, much shit that you're going to have to perfect, you know, whether it's your mental game, your emotional game, your fucking real technical game in the shit that you're doing. There's so much that you're going to have to like get better at and be like this repellent against failure. Not in the way where you try to push failure away, but you try to figure out, you're going to have to try to figure out how to rebound. When you fall down, you get back up, fall down, you get back up. And that's a muscle and a skill that requires a lot of rep.
It requires so much rep.
So much rep. Like,
yeah.
Man, what a great time. I know you and I had some scheduling issues, but it's all so worth it at the end.
I had
such a great time talking to you, and, you know, let this be the first of many, many, many more. You know, I want to hear, you know, you playing at other places, and I want to get into the art, the painting and all of that stuff on the next episode.
Yeah, totally. Like, I wish I could extend this more, because I feel like we can
chop it up forever.
forever, dude.
But we can, you know, space it out, and, you know, we can pick this up at the little bit later this year. And there's no rules to this, man. It's like whatever. And, yeah. And if you have something, hey, man, Ken, I got this project, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Like, I just finished it and I want to get, you know, I want to get the word out. Hit me up and I will definitely, you know, sit and
do this.
You know, I love it. This is, yeah. I live for this stuff.
Yeah, me too, man. I feel it's very energizing and it's very inspiring. And also I feel so seen, you know, I'm like, wow, you were there too, you know, like trilogy days, you know, like this guy knows what's up. Like I don't have to say anything and you already, you feel, you know, like, yeah, it's just like, that's what I love about this, you know, cause I know, you know, we're Vietnamese and we share that, but we also share this, a very similar journey as Vietnamese Americans. And it's not only us, you know, it's this whole community. And now we're all kind of coming together to, I mean, we've been, but now it's like super accumulating to, we're like, hey, Vietnamese American, you were there too. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like we have the capacity now as a community to like, focus on that more, to uplift it more, because we were just on survival mode,
totally, you know,
for so long. And you're not creative when you're on survival mode, you're just surviving the basic needs, you know, in identity, in like so many aspects, you know. But now I feel Asian Americans are, we're like, dude, creative time, baby. So that's all that stuff now. Yeah. So
Dan, thank you so much, man. Good, best of luck to everything and your endeavors. And I'm sure we're going to do it again very soon.
Oh yeah, totally. I'm going to pull up to one of the East parties and then I'm going to DJ.
So. Oh, that would be amazing. All right. Yeah. We're going to keep you, you know, we're
let's do it.
Yeah, we will do that. That's going to be something that we pull off, man.
Yeah. It's going to be so sick, lit. Bro. I'm going to play like some trilogy stuff, play some V-Wave. Oh man.
One of the parties that we just did for Ted, the one that I invited you to, the owner of that house, Dr. Bowen, he loves that. He keeps asking me about these trilogy tracks and where I can find it. So I got to call DJ Slim and figure that out with him. But he loves it. So if you can you imagine playing at his house? But you know what the crazy thing is? Like, there's new wave parties happening all the time in Orange County.
Yeah.
This shit's going on all the time. Like the 50-year-old like set, you know, they're then they show up in costume too. I mean, they show up like in period, you know, gear, right?
Yeah. That's, I love that, you know. I love that so much, you know.
But I'd like to hear like what you got, because then it's like it's that new wave period with a twist. The twist of, you know, qualifying and quantifying sort of like this different vibe that you put your stamp on.
Yeah, I'll send you the link and then download it, bump it in your car and stuff like that.
Okay.
You can hear what I'm talking
about.
I'll
put the link on the description as well. So people can So people can listen to it. Dan, once again, thank you so much, man.
Hell yeah. Thanks. It's good to talk to you, man.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.